Five. A six-year-old football mascot whose battle with cancer touched the England striker Jermaine Defoe has died. Bradley Lowry's mum says he was their little superhero who's now with the Angels. His condition had recently deteriorated and Defoe had become close to the youngster, something which was obvious during an interview yesterday.
Yeah, it's been difficult. It's been hard because I've just kept this in for so long. Obviously trying to be strong for my family and his family as well.
A man's been arrested at Liverpool's John Lennon Airport over the Manchester Arena bombing. The 19-year-old's being held on suspicion of terror offences following the attack in May, which killed 22 people. A 14-year-old girl has died and another pupil has been taken to hospital after a crash on a school trip in Birmingham. The group from John Taylor High in Staffordshire were travelling in a minibus which collided with a bin lorry this morning. Police Superintendent Dean Hatton says it's not known what happened.
It's too early to speculate on what has exactly happened, and as we speak now, collision investigation is occurring.
Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin have met for the first time at the G20 conference in Hamburg. The US president says they've been discussing various issues and he thinks a lot of positive things will come for both their countries. In sport, Johanna Konta has become the first Brit into the fourth round of Wimbledon. Jay Townsend is on centre court.
She's there for the first time after easily beating Maria Sakkari on number one court, 6-4, 6-1. Rafa Nadal looks like he's on his way there too. He's already two sets up on Karen Khachanov on centre. Andy Murray's next up here. The defending champion plays Fabio Fognini. Britain's Heather Watson lost a thriller to Victoria Azarenka, and Ali Ashbedene is also out.
And England's cricketers are firmly in control of the first test against South Africa at Lord's. They've reduced the tourist to 122 for four, still a long way behind the host's first innings score of 458. That's the latest. I'm Annie Green.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, helping us review this week's news at Green Councillor for Clifton Down, and that's Clive Stevens, and former, no longer, UKIP candidate and pornography producer John Langley. After the 6 o'clock news, whatever happened to Brexit? As proposal after proposals the Tories make to Brussels are rejected, is it inevitable there will be no deal? And with such a situation, will Theresa May's minority government be able to get Parliament to pass any of the required laws, including repealing the European Communities Act? As the most direct threat yet to the very existence of the EU, will Jean-Claude Juncker take Brexit lying down? Also, the police progress report this week on the pre-election Manchester Arena terror attack, with thousands of staff investigating. We have a look at what they've found so far about the bomb that killed 22 concertgoers on the 22nd of May. Plus, the 7/7 London bombings. It's the 12th anniversary today. Victims' families were distraught, waiting up to 2 weeks to hear that the coroner had the bodies of their disappeared loved ones. And several years later, the inquest disaster, and how then families were treated appallingly by the Secret Services and the judiciary. Plus, Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. That's in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 16 and dry this weekend, highs of 23, mainly cloudy with a few sunny spells. That's through the weekend. Next week, highs of 22, some heavy showers at the beginning of the week, sunnier though towards the end of the week. Next weekend, that's the 15th and 16th of July, highs of 22, mainly sunny spells. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news, it's Green Councillor for Clifton Down. That is Clive Stevens, and also former UKIP candidate John Langley. Hi, Clive and John, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello, thanks very much for inviting us in.
Thanks, Tony. Hi.
Clive, tell us a bit about yourself. When were you elected and what's your background?
I was elected last May, so I'm pretty new to all this. Before then, I was sort of teenager liking fast cars, went to university, got a career and built a family, and sort of only started thinking about the future when my teenage children were getting to the stage I could think of them as, well, what type of world are we going to do? Are we going to live in? And I teach part-time at university, and Bristol University asked me to do some courses in sustainable engineering, business and engineering. And it was the journey of realising that actually wasn't the engineers why the world is messed
up. What is that? I mean, they stick this word sustainable on everything nowadays, don't they? So sustainable business engineering, what on earth is that?
Well, it's about how you can... sustainability in its broadest sense is how you can continue to doing something.
Well, whether you can continue to get money for it.
Well, in a business sense, you're right, yeah. And that's a sustainable business is one.
See, in the old days, they talked about sustainability as something to do with whether it was going to destroy the planet or not. Nowadays, it just seems if something's sustainable, it's as if you can... if it turns a profit.
From a business point of view, that's exactly right.
So they've changed the use of that word, haven't they?
Yeah, but business are very good at doing all sorts of things like that.
So what sort of things were you teaching anyway?
Well, what we were doing is we were going through the various technology using the old term of the word, Tony, realising that because businesses want to keep making a profit, it's not necessarily in their interests to do sustainable engineering in the broader sense.
Okay, so why the Green Party? Why not another party?
Because I think the Green Party are the ones that realise that everything is broken. The world is in a mess, the UK is in a mess, and a lot of our systems need to be built up again from scratch.
How would you do that?
Oh, how would I do that? If I ruled the world, or even just the UK, I think I'd start on day one. I'd nationalise the housing companies, and then I'd structure that so that half of the companies I keep nationalised that would make make houses for people to live in, and I'd sell off the other half, which can do the luxury houses, which would probably pay for the nationalisation in the first place.
Okay, also joined by John Langley. Hi, John. Could you give us an idea of why... Because you stood as a UKIP candidate, didn't you? Why UKIP?
For my sins, yeah, I did.
So why UKIP?
It was really a marriage of convenience at the time, you know, because of my activities in the adult world and being involved with politics as well. The two just really went together. So it worked well for both of us, really.
You're talking about your activity in the adult world. This is as a pornography producer and star.
Well, I wouldn't call myself a star.
I mean, we've got something in common here, producer, presenters, but different kind of media, I guess. But yeah, what got you interested in pornography?
It's actually through having borderline personality disorder. And if anybody has the diagnosis, then they're either heavily into gambling or heavily into eating or whatever it happens to be. In my case, I was just very sexually active and rather sort of going through and destroying many, many relationships. It seemed that I should sort of channel my energies into something probably better for myself. And so I ended up in that industry.
So you're implying there's something wrong with it. Would you say there is something wrong with pornography?
No. I think if people are sensible about it, and we're all adults.
But you're saying you've got some sort of disorder led you into it.
Yeah. So yeah, it's a diagnosis. But I'm not saying there's anything wrong with it. It just happened to work for me at that time, and it did ever since. So that's
okay.
It.
Do you still do that sort of thing?
Well, every day, sort of. You know, when you've been doing it so many years as I have, every day is Groundhog Day. So I'm kind of. I'm more into sort of political activism nowadays.
So what sort of political activism then?
Well, I'm sure you know about the occupation at Avonmouth when we took the house over. That was very successful. I've recently been on the roof of Symes House in Hartcliffe. We do a lot for helping the homeless because I'm part of Homes for All. And it's just campaigning for people in Bristol, I think, who feel that they've been left behind.
So why not UKIP? I mean, obviously, you've started off with this sort of ideology to do with UKIP. How did you split from them, or what made you decide it wasn't going to work?
I just decided one day that you know, it had run its course. I mean, to be fair, you know, UKIP got me a lot of publicity and it pushed, if you like, my adult film industry figures through the roof.
Do you think you were using UKIP as more than they were using you, or as much as they
both,
were using you?
Definitely both. I would say both.
What sort of relationship was it?
It was very, very good. And, you know, the people in Bristol, I have to say, you know, I've nothing against whatsoever. I've an amazing team of people who were not typically, I think, what people would consider UKIP to be. And I had a marvellous relationship with them. It was sort of, I decided that enough was enough and that I needed to move on, because it was an incredibly busy 2 or 3 years with them.
So isn't it a spent force now, UKIP?
I think so, yeah. I mean, they've done their job. And, you know, they... Most of us, I would have to say, were in it purely to get the vote. And once the people in this country had that vote, or the choice of that vote, then it was time to call it a day.
Well, why is it
and
so important for you? You know, why is it so important to leave the EU?
I'm not saying it. Well, I'm not in. You see, that's interesting, because I'm not in favour of leaving it, and I'm not sort of the other way either. I'm borderline. I've never even made up my mind.
That's what UKIP was all about.
Yeah, sure. But as I say, it was a very useful vehicle for me to promote myself, and that was when it came to the end of relationship, it sort of, you know, it's like arriving at Paddington and then deciding that you're going to go your separate ways, and somebody's going to go on the bus and somebody's going to go on the tube, and that was the end of it.
Also, I saw you nodding when we were talking about housing with Clive.
Yeah.
Why is that so important to you? And I mean, you were nodding when he was talking about nationalising the housing company.
I think it's a really good idea. There is, Clive will bear it out, as you will yourself, there's a huge shortage of housing.
Are we talking about the Barrett homes and these people?
No, we need some more social housing. That's what we need, is more social housing. Unfortunately, you know, during the Thatcher era, everything was sold off and nothing was rebuilt, and this is kind of the mess that we're in nowadays. So we've got to do something now to improve the social housing situation, because there are huge amounts of people on the housing list.
Well, yeah, and we've got half a million migrants net every year. Yeah, so this is keeping the housing market buoyant by increasing demand, and yet we hear from the Halifax, I think it was just yesterday, that it's three quarters now where the house prices are slowly going down. Amazing, since we've got this extra demand of half a million people a year coming.
I think it's going to go bust. I think the housing market is going to crash in the next couple of years, and, you know, we're going to be in serious trouble.
Clive?
I think if the housing market does crash, you're right, we will be in serious trouble, because the last 30 or 40 years our economy has been driven on increasing housing prices. But it's more complicated than that. It's a number of markets that are intersecting. So if you get a load of people who are coming in earning minimum wage or 0 hours contracts, that type of thing, you've got all these issues about housing them, and it doesn't actually affect the housing prices themselves. You've also got more and more students who are creating demand for rooms, who do have access to lots of money now through the loan system, and that has a big impact on lots of rental prices, which then link into house prices for those type of properties.
You could almost imagine some of these house builders who have been building all these student flats around Bristol in the past, leaning on government, saying, "Oh, I think it'd be a really good idea for you to do student loans, so these students can all pay for these wonderful new halls we're building, and that we can get a guaranteed income." Martin?
Yeah, I think that's true. And obviously, this question of the housing market is absolutely central. And I agree that there's quite likely it's going to crash. What else can it do?
The main developers
pop and then crash.
What I was trying to hint at there was that these big developers seem to be totally calling the shots. And most of people like the local authorities can't build council housing, find it really difficult. And even the housing associations, apparently several billion went out of the housing budget in 2010 when Cameron got in to pay for an aircraft carrier. And so it's not considered a priority.
Well, I understand we're going to be discussing the Grenfell Tower incident in a moment, but I mean, if you think about it, in the 70s when that tower went up, the planning regulations in places like London allowed social housing to be created on what were essentially, you know, high value sites. And there was a commitment in this country from the Second World War onwards that we were going to have mixed communities, and that wealthy people and poor people were going to live side by side, which of course doesn't happen in the US, where rich people in Los Angeles live, you know, miles away from poor people. But of course, step by step, we've undermined all of that, and we've now reached the point where the overblown housing market is probably going to pop. But as has been pointed out, that's not just good news. That means the economy goes down the drain. So you've then got to have an industrial strategy or whatever to try and rebuild the economy. And the mismanagement of the housing market has messed up our industry. Basically stop go. Property bubbles in the southeast basically kill off industry north of the Wash, and it's been going on in several waves in my lifetime. And we've deindustrialised completely during that process.
Well, you're right. We are going to be talking about Grenfell. There's lots been happening in the news this week about it all. We'll start. The Tory in charge of Grenfell Tower refurbishment was investigated twice over his role. Rockfielding Mellon was probed after Kensington and Chelsea Council approved a scheme to lease a library building to a prep school at which his children are on the waiting list. So, in other words, it looks like he's trying to use this as a kind of system of backhanders. The Tory in charge of the Grenfell Tower refurbishment was investigated twice over his role. At the deal gave Notting Hill Prep School favourable terms over 25 years and allowed it to skip the first year's rent of £365,000. That dwarfed the £293,000, which would have bought better fireproof cladding at Grenfell, which was rejected on cost grounds. He resigned just as we were on air last Friday, Rockfielding Mellon. There are several, an earlier complaint raised questions over his career as a property developer and his access to privileged information. That was investigated and no conflict of interest apparently was found there. I mean, this guy, Rockfielding Mellon, does seem to be right at the centre of this because he was directly managing the renovation of Grenfell Tower for the council. Also, four men at the centre of the Grenfell Tower fire scandal have now resigned, yet one of them is expected to receive a six-figure payout and another can simply retreat to not just one family country residence, but three in Scotland, Oxfordshire and Gloucestershire. That's that Rockfielding Mellon character, and I'll put a link up to him on our show page. I'm surprised he hasn't had his collar felt yet by the police investigating this. The fire risk assessor at Grenfell was paid £250,000 for his work. He urged the council to bury his own fire risk report. A fire risk assessor who worked on Grenfell Tower repeatedly suggested that Kensington and Chelsea Council could withhold a report from publication detailing the building's safety failings from the London Fire Brigade. Fire consultant Carl Stokes was paid £244,000 over 7 years as the fire risk assessor for Kensington and Chelsea Tenant Management Organisation, KCTMO, according to documents published by Inside Housing. Also, Grenfell Tower victims' families left a meeting after being told relatives may not be identified until the end of the year. Also, they were told to sign a council form, Grenfell Survivors, that would waive their rights. This is a fascinating report by The Guardian. Documents asking people to confirm receipt of compensation money have now been withdrawn, say officials, because lawyers have had a look at them, and they say, well, basically, you're waiving all your rights. So this seems to go on and on. The pain and the anguish, Clive, as 2 weeks ago, is being compounded again and again. Imagine if you're a victim, a family member of one of the victims of this, and someone from the council comes up and said, please sign this piece of paper for your compensation, and there's a little bit in the small print that says that you're waiving your rights to any kind of prosecution in the future.
Well, I'm trying to imagine that now. I'd be utterly furious, and I probably have been worried, sick, I've had sleepless nights, I might not be able to think logically, and I might well sign this just because it gets my hand on some money, which I'm desperate for. I think you probably... it's appalling. Appalling.
Another one is the Daily Telegraph publishing a report entitled, the headline is, The Justice for Grenfell Agitators. A campaign group tries to push Tower Inquiry judge to resign. Well, I mean, calling the people who are survivors of such an attack agitators is not really a balanced piece of journalism from the Tory Telegraph. And also the fire inquiry chair was heckled as he met survivors. And a quote from him is, if I can't satisfy you because you have some preconception about me as a person, that's up to you, says the retired judge. Well, apparently he's really lost the trust through comments like that, and because he's saying that they are maybe have a negative view of him because of some of the decisions that he's made in the past as a judge, which could be described as ethnic cleansing, removing poor people from areas like Kensington and Chelsea. So lots in that. John Langley, what do you make of this?
Dear, oh dear, where do you start? Okay, we can talk about the corruption of politics and the fact that those who tend to get elected in places like Kensington and Chelsea do so because they've got the money to put into it and they buy their way into politics. We can talk about the fact that Grenfell Tower, the cladding, I'm going to be the odd one out here and say that from my own perspective, and I probably am the odd one out, is the fact that building regulations aren't constantly updated, and if they were updated, then probably that cladding would have been removed and something else put in its place. So I think building regulations have a tremendous amount to do with it. I may be wrong, I'm not an expert in that field. But it strikes me that that's one of the things. I think in terms of the judge, yes, we've all made mistakes in the past. We all have a history. You know, let's see what the man does before we start making judgments on him.
I mean, if he's not got the support of the survivors already... I mean, and they haven't been consulted in who is going to conduct this inquiry. I mean, isn't that a basic thing?
You've got to talk to at least
200 people involved in this particular group.
But there's a lot of sidebar issues, and I think we need to cut our way past
those. Is it okay to impose somebody on them?
He's an experienced judge, and I think they ought to give the man the chance first and see what he does. As I said, we all have a past, we all have history, we all have things that maybe we've regretted that if we'd have, in hindsight, we'd have done differently. But, you know, he is a very experienced judge. He has been appointed on the basis of his experience. So let's actually see what he does first before we start making any kind of judgments whatsoever. Because that can be very, very damaging when you start making judgments up front based on what you believe.
He's made a whole career of it, though.
Well, maybe he has, maybe he hasn't, but let's just see what happens.
And before we hear from Martin on this, let's have a listen now to Channel 4 News on Wednesday evening, where the Grenfell Action Group, which flagged up the issues of fire safety, I think it was 2015 when they first started doing this, he's called Joe Delaney, was on Channel 4 News talking with John Snow, the presenter, and also Kevin Holrake, MP, from the Conservative, who's on the Community Select Committee.
Why don't you send someone to help my neighbour, Paul Dillon, who's lost his job today as a crane operator because he's taken so much time off from the tragedy, who was there as the building burned and offered translation services that night. The council were wholly unable to deal with this. The council have got money, they've got credit cards, they've got phones. All people needed in the first instance was a hotel, and even that couldn't be arranged.
Let me ask you something, Joe Delaney, because in fact the residents have been organising themselves. Are you actually able to ameliorate any difficulties that you encounter?
The group at the moment who's been offering the most support is a group called The Real Community, John. It's an umbrella group of all the local voluntary organisations, and they are now a well-oiled machine. No, they were not perfect from the outset. No one expected them to be. This was unprecedented, as people keep saying. But my God, they tried, and my God, they improved, and my God, they listened.
But it does seem, though, quite extraordinary that the council really allowed to run anything at the moment, given the hash it's made of this tower.
Precisely. Well, I don't think they're running anything in terms of Grenfell now. This is
Running other services.
But they're running other services. They're running social services at the moment. They're running education. You know, how can we accept the Audit Commission's judgments on those services when blatantly that the score that they were given, outstanding for housing, was clearly absolute nonsense?
Well, the school is rated by Ofsted, not by the council itself.
Department of the council, when it was audited, it was rated outstanding along with the rest. Kensington and Chelsea, supposedly a flagship council. You know what flagship? The Titanic.
I've been down to Grenfell. I've been into the houses of people who have been affected by this tragedy. I understand the anger, the lack of trust in terms of what has happened that's positive. Of the £5 million set aside, £2.5 million of that has been distributed. Offers of accommodation have been made.
Wholly inadequate offers
and
of accommodation.
Absolutely.
You're
right.
Offering families that were already in overcrowded houses smaller properties.
And I quite understand that. And I think it's absolutely right that we consult the residents, we make sure they get appropriate offers of accommodation. They nobody's compelled to accept any of these offers, and if people want to stay in hotel accommodation rather than a temporary move, then another move to permanent accommodation, I quite understand that. But the biggest issue, I think, is this emotional support about the tragedies, about loved ones that have whose bodies have not been recovered, making sure that people have got proper support from an individual, not just from a body. I think that will help to rebuild this trust.
Well, there's a lot of trust rebuilding to be done there. That was Kevin Holrake, MP, Conservative, who's on the Community Select Committee, speaking to the Grenfell Action Group's Joe Delaney on Channel 4 News on Wednesday. Martin, one of the things that they're constantly saying is that basically the community has just been kind of dealing with this themselves with very little help from government. In fact, some of the offers that have been made, as we were hearing earlier, about these waivers that they were wanting to sign were actually better off not taken because they were trying to fleece the people as they were in that state of shock.
Well, I think the political problem for Kensington and Chelsea Council, and therefore for the government, is the way that they seem to have handled this does not look good. I admit that some of this may be just perception, but that is the perception. And I think what they're saying
is that the services are just simply not there at Kensington and Chelsea Council anymore. They've been stripped away. People have been sacked.
They boasted that they were able to reduce the council tax for the wealthiest people in the country who live in Kensington and Chelsea by saving money, by huge subcontracting chains involved in everything to do with housing. And
officially, apparently, 5 stars for Kensington and Chelsea Council all round.
Yeah, but don't forget they're probably being judged by how far they've carried out subcontracting and how far they've been able to reduce council tax bills, and that's what makes them a flagship council as far as the government are concerned. Now I think what something like this does is it cruelly exposes the whole myth behind all of that, that in actual fact it's efficient to contract services out to people who are not really being managed by the people who are contracting it out. So, you know, this whole tragedy raises real questions about our whole housing policy, which is what we started discussing this hour with. I mean, social housing in this country has been absolutely gutted over 30 years.
Well, as Piers...
And we're now living with the horrifying consequences.
As Piers Thompson, who is part of the Justice for Grenfell group, lives very close by to Grenfell Tower and is a DJ, he says, actually, it's a lot of it is simply to do with privatisation. And I had a chat to him a couple of days ago on Wednesday evening, and here is now Piers Thompson from Justin for Grenfell giving his view from ground zero, really.
My name's Piers Thompson. I live opposite Grenfell Tower on the other side of the railway track, the Hammersmith and City line. So I saw the fire on the night. I was woken up at about 1:15 and I heard voices in the next door garden, which is actually George Clark, the fellow from Channel 4. I thought someone was breaking into his home, but in fact it turned out that they were shouting at the tower block, shouting at the people up there to get out, get out. And in fact, when we looked out the window, which is somewhere between 1:15 and 1:15, the flames were just licking up the side of the building. And then my wife called the fire brigade, and they said they'd already been called. We called our very close friend in the tower, and he said he'd just got out. And then we looked, kind of mesmerised by the horror, as the building went up. It seemed that the flues on the edges of the building created a chimney effect. It shot up, you know, like Blade Runner or some, you know, sci-fi movie or the chemical works. And then the fire spreads laterally, which I think must have been the burning cladding. And within, I would say, 30-35 minutes, the entire building was engulfed in flames.
I mean, it sounds pretty horrific, but I mean, there were, I understand, warnings of this beforehand.
There were warnings. I mean, the buddy I was telling you about, who got out through the kind of amazing bravery of one of the firefighters, he is one of the publishers of the Grenfell Action blog, which was a residents group who were campaigning against the council's decision first to plonk a new school on their only open green space, and then subsequently tracking the activities of the council as they refurbished the building. And one of their major concerns was the fire endless potential hazards. Everything from the way it was being done to the council's whole attitude to fire safety.
People will be angry that they've warned about this and yet it was still allowed to happen. But what about the council and the government's reaction since?
Yes, I mean, the survivors are kind of too traumatised to even think about it. But no one turned up on the day. And to be honest, no one much turned up for about a week. The entire response was orchestrated by local, you know, at first very local people pouring out, opening up places like the Maxilla Club and the Latimer Christian Centre. Then people flooded onto the streets and just, people worked as though they were a colony of bees. You know, they just worked out what they needed to do and how they needed to do it. So at first, the response was really all about trying to help. And, you know, that carried on and on because we got no help from central government or local government. There was obviously a lot of anger because you can't allow a building with 500 people in it to go up at the speed that building went up. You know, a lot of people in there didn't stand a chance. And so the anger, it first came to the surface, I think, with the storming of the town hall. Then we had another event, a silent march, and the silent march looked as though it might turn nasty, but tempers were calmed. We're now, 2 weeks later, we're in a position, we have a group called Justice for Grenfell, which is kind of the local groups around here, work on things like housing issues and, I suppose, generally community issues. And it's quite difficult. I suppose what we're trying to do is create a platform so when the survivors come back to out of shock and out of the trauma, they have a platform from which to seek justice for themselves. But it is quite difficult because there's so much anger and frustration, you know, both with what happened in the past, what's happening on a daily basis in terms of people not being rehoused as quickly as they were supposed to be, or being messed around. And of course, there's the whole question of how many people actually are in the tower. So, yes, there's loads of anger and frustration. And it's, on the one hand, you know, just if I was to go outside my house now, it would be like Speaker's Corner in Hyde Park. Everyone on the corner chatting, talking, you know, discussing issues. It's like, that's almost exhilarating, the way people are participating in, I suppose, democracy. But on the other hand, you know, we're all so angry. The people who are the victims, the survivors, the families and so on, are in a state of shock. We haven't yet found a way, I think, of channeling that anger into creating some better conditions for people, both right here, right now, and more generally up and down the country.
What about this public inquiry? Because the government will say, well, this is going to attempt to get to the bottom of it all.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that I'm doing at the moment is that I don't mind if this middle-aged, middle-class white man, who's obviously quite a good judge, but obviously has slightly questionable views about social housing. I think if they want him to do an inquiry just about the fire and causes of it and all that sort of thing, that's fine. I do think that this is an atrocity so great that we need something like the Taylor Report after Hillsborough, or the McPherson Report after Stephen Lawrence, to look at the whole issue of social housing. So what I've been trying to do with some of the people who've been in contact with me since I popped up talking about these things is get an independent report commissioned that will look into the wider issues of what I would perceive to be the callous disregard that the people in power treat ordinary people and their constituents.
In Haringey, a company has been created to act as a vessel to sort of channel public land, which would use for public housing, towards the private sector. Now, of course, there is another aspect to all of this, which is that you know, in Kensington and Chelsea, during the general election, was the last constituency to be declared with a tiny minority. And actually, many of the people that voted Labour were probably from that Grenfell Tower, actually constituted that tiny majority that voted Labour. So there is this aspect of Conservative, particularly... and also property developers wanting to get, as we saw 20 years ago with Shirley Porter in Westminster, to get Labour voters out.
Yes. Regeneration, which means demolishing people's homes, scattering the community and letting a few come back, is obviously going to change communities. What we saw in the last, whatever, 2 weeks, is how strong and cohesive this community is and the power that it can generate when it has to react to a crisis with literally zero help from any form of government. There's no value put on that in any of these financial viability reports. It's all about the numbers of the square meters and that sort of thing. There's a huge value to community, and we've got to start factoring that in to these viability assessments. Because it's worth more than £0. Our fight here is with the Tory council, and you know, one of the reasons that Labour won Kensington, you know, obviously the youth came out, but also there were a lot of kind of disillusioned. I've always voted, but a lot of my friends, other DJs, voted for the first time. There were a lot of people who the council have annoyed so much by trying to close their college, their library, knock down their homes. We've got a Tory council. I mean, what Haringey appeared to have done is, if anything, even more shocking. So it's not a party political thing. It's the people in power, and it's the ordinary people that they're supposed to represent. And we really have to check that we've got that relationship defined as it should be.
You live around the sort of Ladbroke Grove area. Can you tell, for people that haven't actually visited that part of London, how it stands out from other parts of the city?
Yeah, I mean, we're part of North Kensington. In fact, where we are now is very close to where the 58 race riots broke out. And it's been a mixed community forever. I mean, the race riots broke out because we had a lot of West Indians here, but before that there had been Indians. So there's a huge tradition of white working class, kind of liberal bohemians, and immigrants from First Ireland, from India, from the Caribbean. Also, it's where a lot of the counterculture, a lot of the protest movements of the 60s and the 70s arose. So the spirit of that is in the area. Specifically around Grenfell Tower is what used to be Notting Dale, which were the working class districts, which were considered to be as rough as they possibly can be throughout the, say, 19th century. And that all those old buildings were knocked down. And what we have now is what used to be a white working class community, you know, with long, long roots in the neighbourhood. And there's a strong tradition of that here. But then also, we have welcomed with open arms people from all over the place. So one of the things John Snow remarked upon when he came down here, the guy from Channel 4, is he'd never seen such diversity. You know, he's been talking about diversity for years on his TV show, but it wasn't until he came here that he saw diversity. And we have people from everywhere. So there's 43 languages spoken, what used to be my daughter's primary school. So it's a fabulous community full of probably slightly stroppy people in some way. So that's why you've seen quite such an outpouring of quite well-organised protest. And that's also partly because this area is littered with groups who've been campaigning on, you know, housing issues, some other social issues, some other privatisation issue. So we've got a kind of well-connected network here. And obviously, everyone's so horrified by Grenfell Tower that we're all doing our level best to, in our own ways, bring justice and, you know, help right now.
Can you direct us towards, you know, sort of campaigns, websites, that sort of thing, where people can check this out?
Yeah. The main website for for us, I suppose, is grenfellforjustice.co.uk. That's a four, you know, rather than F-O-R. So Grenfell for Justice, all one word. There's a good Facebook group called Solidarity with Grenfell, which was started by people from around here. And the group that represents the actual survivors and other family members is called Grenfell United. And I don't think that they're quite up and running yet.
Well, Grenfell United, apparently they are more of a sort of personal face-to-face group. They're not really, don't have much of an online presence. But look, one of the things, there's lots and lots of things that Piers brought up there, Martin Summers, but one of them is the fact that Labour are doing exactly the same sort of thing in Haringey, a £2 billion deal to sell off public land, public housing, to a private business.
Yeah, disgusting, and that's new. That's the new Labour dead wood that's still in control of councils around the country, and of course that's unfinished business in terms of internal Labour Party politics.
Either of you two got any comments on what you just heard?
Yeah, it's all right. Thanks. I think it is political. That's the one thing I disagree with in that commentary, which. Sort of, it hurts listening to that because it brings back the horrifying situation. If you take Bristol, we have a Labour, very strong Labour. We have mayor, etc. They're having to implement conservative policies because if they don't, then the council's budget won't match, and then the Tories will take over anyway. They'll be able to send people down from London and run the council. So that's there's subtleties between Corbyn Labour and the other Labour, but I think overall, even councils are having to follow Tory policies. The other thing that was in it that I do agree with is trust. Key thing to rebuild trust. There's no chance of rebuilding trust there. My understanding is that it's been a one-party state in Kensington and Chelsea since 1964, since it was set up. If you don't have, if you have one-party states, however, whatever, you just don't have the democratic checks and balances. And so a lot of this, the fact they weren't prepared, the fact they were cutting costs, I think Martin said they possibly in a competition even with Westminster to try and have the lowest council taxes. That's not what a council is there for. It's to provide services for the people, and especially in cities where we need services because we're all crammed together.
And we're being told, aren't we, but actually that local funding, the rate support grant, is going down to zero by 2020, 2021. I mean, they're just implementing a central government policy.
Yeah,
but you're actually making excuses for Marvin here. Surely they should be fighting back.
Indeed, they should be fighting back. And Marvin has said that it's finding the right time to make that fight. Now, I can't make a judgment on that because I'm not up at Westminster talking to senior ministers. But I get the feeling that all the cities are not really fighting enough.
I mean, it's not just Kensington and Chelsea, is it? It's almost like Bristol too. The latest administration that's been brought in for the next 4 or 5 years, they're like John Langley. I want to make you this. It's almost like we've voted in our official receivers.
Yeah. I mean, I've been calling Marvin the pink poodle for a long, long time for, you know, following the Tory cuts, I'm afraid. He's a lovely man, and, you know, I wouldn't take that away from him. But in terms of running the council, I'm not going to comment any further. What I would say, I think he is showing very weak leadership. I would have stuck my fingers up to the government and said, on your bikes, mate, because I think if Bristol City Council would have done that, other councils would have followed suit and the government would have crumbled in no time at all.
Also, some other news this week. A Metro bus boss has... Did you want to come back?
Yeah, I was going to... finding a huge amount of agreement here, aren't we?
I see we're on the same side already.
Yeah. And
I want you to disagree. I want a round.
Yeah, well, that's why I thought putting UKIP and Green. So sorry to mess that up. I think now is the time, and if Marvin's can do it, but he does, he's quite cerebral. Maybe one of the other Labour city leaders. They need almost like the cities to go to march on Westminster and tell Westminster, you are strangling half the population, all of the wealth creating areas, and, you know, change the policies. That there's a huge raft of things they need to do differently. The system is broken, and all they're doing is tinkering.
Well, yeah. Clive, I'd love to give you the opportunity to ask Marvin that live on this programme. The only trouble is I've put several invites into him for him to come on this programme. Although he does come on other programmes here on BCFM, he just seems to have kind of, should we say, shuffle around this one. In fact, he did agree to come on two or three months previously, just before the Metro Mayor elections, and I got a phone call at the last minute where he backed out. I've got another attempt. I put a phone call in again this week to try and get Marvin to come in, and they didn't get back to me again. So you just got to keep. I'm going to have to keep banging my head against this, hopefully not brick wall, and get Marvin in here. And when I do, I'll get you to put these questions to him as well, because I think, you know, we do need some leadership from our leaders. Yeah, and it doesn't seem like, John, it doesn't seem like that's happening here.
He's not getting it at all. I mean, one of the worst. I mean, to be honest with you, in some ways I miss George, because at least with George you knew where the hell you stood, what he was up to, even if you didn't like it.
Is it a bit like Thatcher and Blair?
Oh God, don't even go there. You know, I mean, no, I just don't know, you know.
You knew where you stood with Margaret Thatcher,
you,
didn't you?
You did, but, you know, with what is this guy up to next? He doesn't say anything. You know, there's no leadership there, what I would call strong leadership there whatsoever.
Come on, Marvin, come on the programme, show us you're a leader. Yeah. Martin, what do you make of this?
Well, I can see what the criticisms are. I think he's in a very difficult position.
What about this idea of having a whole bunch of cities marching on Westminster and saying that you're actually strangling us, as Clive said there?
We didn't campaign on the basis that, as I'm a member of the Labour Party, on the basis that we were going to defy the government.
No, that's not defying the government. No. By marching, having a march.
We can have a march, but then you've
got
to make sure
that
people turn up if you're going to march.
Are we not allowed
to
not allowed to do that in Martin's Britain?
No, you ask me what I think, then you're interrupting me. I think the fact is, I mean, Sinn Féin were originally not going to join the executive in Northern Ireland because they weren't going to implement Tory cuts. Their base, which is basically the nationalist community in Northern Ireland, were ready for that, and they've had years and years and years of armed conflict with the government, so they're ready. I don't think the working class in Bristol or anywhere else is ready yet. So I pick up the point that was made earlier about timing. At some point, this government will be ready for a good kick, but we've got to get it right, and we've got to get them where it hurts.
It doesn't sound like there's a Labour Party that's going to do that. Maybe somebody else is going to do it. I mean, also, of course, we've seen marches in this city already, Martin.
Yeah, but marches are all very well, and I'm all in favour of marches. But
you're just showing public, you know, some sort of public demonstration of disquiet, and also an alternative vision, because at the moment we don't have any kind of vision from central government at all.
No, the central government we've got now is on is on borrowed time. There's going to be further crises. There's going to be a housing collapse, a banking collapse, possibly a war with Russia and Syria. That will definitely collapse the banking system. And we should have been talking about the banking system for the last 8 years. We talk about it on this show, but most of the rest of the society have presumed that the banks are safe. They're not.
In the meantime, Bristol's poorest households and those on benefits could be forced to pay council tax. The council is currently consulting on changes to council tax exemptions here in Bristol. Now, yeah, you saying you almost welcome George Ferguson. Well, I mean, he used to come on this programme and he used to keep to the appointments that he made here, as well as making sure that there were exemptions for people with no money. Seems that, Clive, that people with nothing have got to pay this tax in future.
I know it's appalling, and that's something I've looked in possibly since I've been a councillor, because on the Green Group I'm quite good at the finances, the numbers, not so much with the words. I think it's lack of courage. Courage is what we need, and the courage needs to come from the cities where the pain is most. And the type of courage we need to do, there's this consultation out at the moment getting people, the poorest people, to pay tax because the UK doesn't make the richest people pay enough tax. That really, really is insulting. And I think what we need, what he should have done, is a consultation, maybe with this type of offer, with the offer of closing all the libraries and all the parks and chopping down the trees, which it also is after, in conjunction with thinking about a local referendum to increase the council tax. Because I've heard people telling me, look, this is such a mess, I'm happy to pay more council tax. But that's people in your F and G and H, you know, the richer houses. Yeah. And it's a council tax is a dreadfully unfair tax anyway. But if you increase it and you keep the council tax reduction scheme, so 25% don't pay any, then you're turning an unfair tax into something that's a bit fairer.
Sounds like that's one of the more sensible contributions to this consultation. John, what do you make of council tax?
Ooh. Well, you know, it's what happens here in Bristol, I'm sure it happens in other places as well, is that when they implement all these lovely cuts and stuff, it doesn't affect the people in Redland or Clifton or Bishopsworth. It affects the people who have the least. So, you know, I'm very pleased to see that Marvin is sort of following the party line of for the many, not the few, in that respect, because it is the few who are getting hurt very, very badly. And I can see a point in this city where there's going to be a riot when the people have just absolutely had enough. And the mayor will not see it coming because he doesn't have the experience, he doesn't have the know-how, he doesn't have the political nous, he doesn't have the knowledge to actually to see what he's doing to this city. And there's going to be massive problems if we don't get it right now, and there is going to be a riot, and I would put my money on that.
On to another story, actually a national story, which has been in the news relating to Bristol this week, and that's Bijan Ebrahimi. The police have failed the murdered man for years, we hear. Disabled Iranian refugee repeatedly reported death threats and racial abuse to police for 7 years before being brutally murdered, a report was found. Bijan Ebrahimi was beaten to death and set alight on a Bristol estate amid false claims that he was a paedophile. The IPCC said he'd been treated consistently differently from his neighbours in what could be racial bias, conscious or unconscious. Avon and Somerset's police chief said, "We failed him in his hour of need." Mr. Ibrahimi's sisters, his sisters anyway, very difficult to pronounce names, two of them. Independent Police Complaints Commission report showed how terrible a life he had had during those last few years. Ebrahimi was killed by his neighbour Lee James in Brislington, July 2013. Now, Martin, maybe we'll start with you on this one. This is pretty horrific that there's actually endemic racism, it seems, in Avon and Somerset in this case.
Well, it's obviously a horrifying case. The police and the social services and the council didn't do their job properly. And it's a very sad state of affairs. And, they'll have to do something to try and make sure it doesn't happen again, won't they?
Isn't there a bit of a problem, John, with accountability with the police here? There's not enough scrutiny?
Not enough scrutiny, and equally I think the council are culpable. Again, oh dear, you know, this is sort of like cladding under a different name, isn't it? It's just an absolute disaster which never should have happened. Again, a poorly run, mismanaged council where officers can seem to do what they like and they're not accountable to anybody. That's what really worries me about Bristol City Council, is that the officers seem to be overruling the council, the actually elected members, like my colleague to my right here, and they think they can get away with what they like. And I think this is another case of why this poor man was persecuted the way he was, because he wasn't properly taken care of and looked after in the way that he should have been. So it's as much to do with the council as to do with the police.
Clive, the IPCC is saying that Benjamin's complaints about abusive neighbours were disbelieved by the police. He was considered to be a liar, a nuisance and an attention seeker.
Yes, I read that too. I don't know much about this case apart from what I've read, and I'm told that the council and the police will be doing their own inquiries. I think when it gets that serious, you do eventually get down to the truth. The council is still, certainly Bristol is still a democratic institution, whereas I'd argue some of the others might not be, which we've been speaking of earlier this evening.
Well, one of the great flagship projects for the city is the Metro Bus, and we just heard this week the Metro Bus has quit its council job days after a report revealing that the costs have gone up again. That's the Metro Bus scheme, which is due to launch in the autumn. The person responsible for a large section of the Metro Bus project quit his job. Chris Sane, S-A-N-E, you can't make these names up, can you? He's resigned from his top South Gloucestershire job just days after the news Metro Bus costs had increased by several million pounds since November. The BBC is reporting Mr. Sane left his head of transport and strategic project role last month after a report detailed costs for the North Fringe section of the route had spiralled by £4.6 million, an extra £4.6 million, John.
No surprise there. You know, what doesn't spiral? Because things start off at 10 million, and before you know it, they're 20 million, and before you know it again, they're 30 million, and before you know it's the same story as with the marina. So, you know, the fact that this is spiralling costs doesn't surprise me in the least.
What's wrong, Clive, that projects like this can go so way over budget, and someone all he's doing is he's just walking out of his responsibilities now?
Well, earlier on, I've said basically everything is broken, and this is an example. So let's talk about why this.
Well, you're a councillor. You're supposed to scrutinise these things.
Well, not in in South Gloucester, but also the issue is you get these reports come up with from the expert officers who put these costings in. They tend to be optimistic in order to get the grants, in order to get it through, and then if you're optimistic, if a few things go wrong, you end up with overruns. Why can't they be realistic as opposed to optimistic? The system's wrong, because if you're not optimistic, you don't get the thing done. So probably the guy was doing the right thing. I think both John and I, we both believe lots and lots of the systems are broken. You come across as very thoughtful, and that's probably why you've left UKIP.
Yes.
My understanding is that Greens think, we believe that lots of the systems are wrong. A number of us are trying to come up with different ideas, but it's not that easy. And I suspect a lot of UKIP felt the same, and UKIP have got a different solution.
Because it's a similar sort of thing, and I mean, maybe stretching a point with Grenfell here, where you've got contracts which are at arm's length. This is public money being spent. There's no really proper scrutiny about the way it's being spent. There's contracts, there's subcontracts. It's all at a great distance. And then when something goes wrong, everyone's pointing the finger at somebody else down the line.
Yeah, it is a bit like that in business anyway, because often big business is subcontracting and subcontracting, but you don't find out the cock-ups because they're not democratic institutions. So I've been in businesses where sort of halfway down the supply chain and you see the top people make a cock-up, and by the time you get to the bottom, it can bankrupt
so
companies.
So is Bristol City Council a democratic institution?
Relatively.
Yeah. Martin.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, what's the alternative? I mean, there's always room for improvement, isn't there?
I mean, we're hearing, for example, with Green Capital, another example there, that quite a lot of the meetings there were held where people weren't allowed to scrutinise, they weren't allowed to look, and then when it came to the accounts again, they're not there for people to scrutinise. So is that sort of thing happening quite a lot?
Oh, okay.
Quick, wasn't sure. Within one word, yes or no?
No, it doesn't happen, but it's getting... The risk is there's a bit more because the council itself is setting up businesses and they're less democratically accountable.
Okay, anyway, time for the Murdoch News at 6 now. Thanks to our guests, Green Councillor for Clifton Down, that's Clive Stevens, and also to former UKIP candidate John Langley. After the Murdoch News, whatever happened to Brexit?
Bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.